Hello, everyone. This recording replaces conference call number 3 that was canceled. My apologies for the last-minute cancellation of it. Please listen to this recording for some of the important information that is shared in Week 3 of RM 103, Understand Legal Risk. During Week 1 of RM 103, we talked about 4 factors that the courts use to determine negligence. Last week, we looked at 4 different ways that responsibility or liability for negligence may be assigned. You will remember from our call that liability is about who is responsible for negligent behavior. This week, in Week 3, we look at 3 ways a defendant may be able to escape liability. And then in Week 4, we will look at how liability can be minimized by transferring risk. Slide 29 shows you that it may be possible for a defendant to escape liability if, 1, the plaintiff's own actions contributed to the injury, or the plaintiff voluntarily assumed risk of injury, and or the plaintiff signed a valid waiver form. Let's start with contributory negligence that's described briefly on slide 30 and in Activity 8. This type of negligence focuses on the plaintiff's behavior. People who use your facilities and participate in your activities are expected to take reasonable care. If someone's own behavior led to their injury, this person may be partially liable. So to establish contributory negligence, courts determine or ask how much of a factor was the plaintiff's behavior in the outcome and the damages sustained. To what extent could the plaintiff be expected to take reasonable care given factors such as age and ability? Or would the accident have happened or been less severe if the plaintiff had acted differently? If a plaintiff is found to be contributory negligent, the settlement can be reduced proportionally. For example, if the plaintiff is found 10% contributory negligent, then a $1 million settlement is reduced by 10%, and the plaintiff would only get $900,000. Let me share an example from Hamilton, Ontario. An individual dove into a pool from a diving board and contacted a submerged safety wall. This resulted in a serious injury. In the lawsuit, the plaintiff claimed negligent construction or negligence because of the construction of the pool and alleged that the submerged wall constituted a hidden danger. But in court, it came out that the plaintiff was an experienced swimmer who knew that the safety wall was there. The court also determined that the pool was a modern design and had been supervised during construction by a competent engineer. The court found no negligence on the part of the municipality because the plaintiff knew about the submerged wall. As the court put it in its proceedings, the plaintiff's actions constituted an entire absence on his part of the use of reasonable care, and the plaintiff was found to be the sole author of his injuries. Keep in mind that contributory negligence applies only to the conduct of a plaintiff. The defense of contributory negligence comes into play where it is established that the conduct of a participant was unreasonable or dangerous in the circumstances and contributed to the injuries sustained. Not only did defendants have a duty to reasonably prevent foreseeable injury, but participants in recreation and sport are under the same duty to prevent their own injury. For those of you who are lawyers for the defense, be sure to consider contributory negligence when making your case. Another way for a defendant to escape liability is informed consent. Again, this is explained in Activity Number 8, and you can find more information on slide 31. You will recall that inherent risks are risks considered normal or natural to an activity. they cannot be eliminated without changing the primary nature of that activity. There is inherent danger in all activities of some level. By participating, individuals acknowledge and accept these risks. An informed consent form raises awareness of inherent risks. When a participant signs such a form, they agree to and assume the risks or the physical risks that are inherent to an activity. It's important to know, though, that participants do not agree to legal risks that result from improper supervision, faulty equipment or facilities, or the inadequate training of an activity leader. An informed consent form provides examples of the types of injuries that can happen in different recreation settings. Your form might list typical injuries for an activity such as Nordic skiing, or it might be broadly worded and include lots of different risks. We call this the kitchen sink approach. Let's take a look at informed consent through several questions. So the first is, what information should be included in an informed consent? Well, if you think about it, these forms should provide examples of the types of injuries that can happen in various and/or specific recreation activities. So, next question, when is an informed consent administered? Well, you generally administer those when somebody registers for your program. Another question, can an informed consent form be used for a minor? Yes, they can, and often we call these a parental consent form because the parent is signing on behalf of a minor. And a last question, is an informed consent form a waiver? No, an informed consent form is not the same as a waiver, but informed consent is always the first part of a waiver form. It is really important to understand that an informed consent is not a release of liability or a waiver, and because it's not a waiver, it can be part of other documents like a registration package. So with informed consent, a participant accepts physical or inherent risks. As you can see on slide 32, a waiver or release of liability is different. It asks a participant to accept both physical and legal risk. When a participant signs a waiver, he or she can participate in an activity, but by signing, gives up the right to sue. So, how does this work? As you can see on slide 32 and may have learned in Activity 8, a valid waiver is a signed legal contract that may protect an organization in a negligent suit. And it may do this because it transfers risk from the organization to the participant. This means that by signing, the participant agrees to not hold the organization responsible for any damages inflicted on the participant, even if this damage was a result of negligence by the organization or one of its employees. Because a waiver asks a participant to accept both physical and legal risks, a waiver is a two-part document. The first part is informed consent, so the one we just talked about, and the second part is a release of liability or a waiver. These parts should be separate and distinct. In the second part, which is the release, this is where the person signing the waiver agrees to waive their right to sue. Because a waiver is a contract, and because we have contract law, a participant can give up their right to sue even if there is negligence, provided they understood what they were signing. In Canadian law, and this is really important for those of us in recreation to know, minors cannot sign away their own rights, and parents, guardians cannot sign away the rights of a minor. Therefore, you can't use waivers with minors and will instead use a parental consent form. Waivers should be developed by a lawyer or adapted from another waiver and then reviewed and approved by a lawyer. Most of us, me included, don't have the ability to create a waiver with the correct legal wording. I want to take a moment for you to pause and remind yourself or jot down on a piece of paper the difference between an informed consent and a waiver. Although a signed waiver gives away the right to sue, it does not waive negligence. Courts generally don't like waivers, but they can be valid if they are administered properly and in the right situations. Unfortunately, waivers can be difficult to administer properly. As slide 33 and activity 8 show, it is generally recommended to use waivers for high-risk programs like overnight hikes, high-risk participants like very young children or elders, except we can't waive the rights of a child, or high-risk facilities like a rock climbing wall. To decide when to use a waiver, use the risk matrix that was introduced in RM 101. Slide 34 and 35 explain that waivers should be administered before an activity begins. Participants must be able to read the waiver and ask questions about it. Staff must point out that the waiver is a legal document in which the person signing it gives up some fundamental rights, such as the right to sue. Signatures on a waiver should be witnessed. Transferring risk through a waiver is not as easy as it seems. As slide 36 explains, if someone doesn't understand the purpose of a waiver, or if it is administered incorrectly, it will not transfer legal risk from the organization or program leader to the participant. Now that you understand more about waivers, think about in your own mind when you might use a waiver, when you might decide not to use a waiver, and keep in mind that you're looking at the instances of use when you have high-risk programs, participants, and facilities. So before ending our call, I would like to remind you, or this recording, I would like to remind you that your RLA making a case is due on Friday. That's tomorrow because I'm recording this on Thursday. It is really important you complete this on time because you will need to review each other's cases before next week's conference call. Thank you. And please let me know if you have any questions.